Previously on Supermate's House of Franklinside.
Aw, crap. You two, Cain and Abel.
Hold on, hun. They're not here to complain this time. They're here to sign the contract.
What contract?
A lawyer doesn't like to be kept waiting. Oh, yes. You don't want to anger him.
Oh, no. I'm not signing any contract. I know who your lawyer is.
Ah, but miss, since last we met, we were bought out by other interests. Yes, even more powerful interest. Right this way, gentlemen.
Oh, boy! It'll sure be swell doing business with you.
Gorsh, I can't wait to check out that spooky house.
But now that we're partners, we do get free admission to the parks, right?
Ha! Not on your life, pal!
Even I have to pay to get in.
Well, okay then, there you go. It's signed.
Okay, pal, see you real soon. Why? Because we own you, ha!
And now the season premiere of Supermate's House of Franklinstein.
What are you staring at?
Oh, just the old house and all the work that was done on it since last year. I'm just wondering what this Zoom call is going to mean.
I can't believe we finally got out from under this thing, and after all this construction, now they can't open their little theme park attraction.
Well, even that...
Hey, who let you guys in?
1,000 pardons. The door was unlocked. Oh, yes. 1,000 pardons. 1,000,000 of them.
Oh, jeez. Cain and Abel again? What are you doing here?
We thought we would take this Zoom call together since we are involved as well.
Yes, Cain is too cheap to pay for the interwebs.
Quiet, you simpering fool. I'll choke you to death with a fiber optic cable.
Well, you two just keep your mask on and stay back 6 feet. Now, make it 12.
Solomon Grundy interested in Zoom meeting too. Grundy want to know if you're going to have a lucrative career in the scaring business.
Now, hold up, guys. We don't need everyone crammed in around our...
Oh, splendid, a party. There's less than 10 of us, so it'll be permissible, yes?
Both of you keep back and put your mask on.
Oh, don't worry about me, my lovely. You can't catch anything from a ghost. Besides, I don't have a head.
Okay, it's time. Let's check the computer and see if they're on.
It says MM is talking.
Hello?
I believe you have your mic muted.
Oh, geez, sorry. Here we go. Hello?
Hiya, pals.
Hi.
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 So we'll keep this short. You want to give them the news?
Gosh, okay. Well, folks, we're going to have to let you go.
What?
Let us go? What does that mean?
The company has took a bath this year, and we can't afford to sink any more money into small projects like this one and the houses of mystery and secrets. Sorry.
But you're going to tear the house down and haul it away, right? You can rebuild it in the parks or something.
Huh? Sorry, pal. That's too much money and hassle, too. We're just going to tear down everything we built around them, pack up and go.
Holy cow, look out the window. They tore down everything but the house, and the trucks are already driving off. Man, you guys work quick.
Now, wait a minute. We signed a contract.
Read the fine print, and you'll see we can pull out at any time. Why? Because we want to.
It's been a pleasure doing business with you.
Wait, don't we get some annual passes for when all this blows over or something?
Mouse out!
Well, so much for that resolution.
We're stuck with this house again.
I suppose we should get back to our respective homes. Apparently there is work to be done.
Oh, yes. Yes, lots of work. Lots of stories to tell.
Grundy don't want to go back to the shack. Grundy needs change.
I was so looking forward to scaring a new crop of folks. Oh, well, I suppose torturing you two will have to do. Ta-ta for now.
Well, I guess you know what this means.
Well, I might as well fire up the Blu-ray player. Look at it this way. Most Halloween events are going to be canceled this year. The least we can do is give our listeners a Halloween party they can go to.
Terry, the music, please.
There's a creepy old house out in the hills, a domicile of weirdness, horror, and thrills, where you never have to wait in line. It's the house of Frankenstein. A strange couple there. Who are your hosts? They talk of comics and movies with monsters and ghosts. A peculiar place where the sun doesn't shine. It's the house of Frankenstein.
Hello and welcome to episode 91 of Supermates, a husband and wife geek cast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Cindy.
And welcome to our first episode of The House of Frankenstein for 2020. Oh boy, a lot has changed since our last episode, hasn't it?
Just a smidgen.
Because we haven't done an episode since the last House of Frankenstein of Supermate. So
yeah,
there you go. But we want to provide a break from the scary reality we now all live in and get back to some good old-fashioned comfy scares. And since Halloween is probably going to be a lot different for all of us in some ways, let's have some fun with the one thing we know we can enjoy together, great classic horror films. Last year, we somehow managed to not cover a Universal horror film. I don't know how we managed to do that.
I don't either.
I don't know what we were thinking then. I don't know. We're going to make up for it this year, starting out with one I personally think is an overlooked gem. Son of Dracula was released November 5th, 1943. November 5th, 1943. Missed it by like a week.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean,
it's just like, what?
Oh boy, we always talk about that, but they really did. Directed by Robert Siodmak, original story by Kurt Siodmak, and screenplay by Eric Taylor. In the cast, we had Robert Page as Frank Stanley, Louise Albrighton as Catherine Caldwell, Evelyn Anchors as Claire Caldwell, Frank Craven as Dr. Harry Brewster, J. Edward Bromberg as Professor Laszlo, Samuel S. Hines as Judge Simmons, Adeline DeWalt Reynolds as Madam Queen Zimba, Pat Moriarty as Sheriff Dawes, Ida McDaniel as Sarah, Jess Lee Brooks as Stephen, George Irving as Colonel Caldwell, and Lon Chaney Jr. as Count Dracula.
In the Deep South, Frank Stanley and Dr. Harry Brewster arrive at the local train station to pick up visiting dignitary Count Alucard, who is set to visit their friends the Caldwells at their plantation, Dark Oaks. Stanley and Brewster find the Count isn't on the train, but his luggage, several trunks, and two large chests are. With one of the large crates on its side, Brewster notes the spelling of Alucard looks familiar, but quickly drops the notion. At Dark Oaks, elder Caldwell daughter Catherine is disappointed to find the Count didn't arrive with his luggage, but informs a servant to take his heavy chest and trunks to the guest house. Catherine tells her skeptical younger sister Claire she knows the Count will arrive that night via her belief in ESP. Catherine heads off deep into the swamp to the shack of Queen Zimba, the gypsy crone who she has given a home to. Zimba tells Catherine she has called her there to warn her. She sees Dark Oaks in ruins and Catherine married to a corpse.
You do not know why you came here tonight. It was because I wished you here.
Why? Isn't Count Alucard
right? I wished you here to warn you. The angel of death hovers over a great house. I see it in ruins. Weeds, vines growing over it. Bats flying in and out the broken windows.
But I want to know of Count Alucard. Is he coming? Do you hear me? Do you hear me, Queen Zimba?
Alucard is not his name. You must stop him before it is too late. stop him before death comes to Dark Oaks.
Tell me if he is coming tonight.
I see you marrying a corpse, living in a grave. I see...
Suddenly, a large bat flies into the shack, literally scaring Zimba to death, who collapses from a heart attack.
Later that evening, a planned reception for Count Alucard is held at Dark Oaks without the guest of honor. But the Count is in attendance, lurking outside. Plantation owner and the girl's father, Colonel Caldwell, calls it a night, and his daughters, Frank and Dr. Brewster, bid him good night. The wheelchair-bound colonel's rest and nightcap cigar are interrupted by Count Alucard, who changes into a bat and sneaks into the house and the colonel's room.
Outside the house, Catherine and Frank have a heart-to-heart. Frank tells her he knows of Zimda's death. Frank doesn't believe in the occult as Catherine does and doesn't understand how she changed since her trip to Budapest where she met Zimba and Count Alucard.
Oh, they'll ask questions. What was I doing there? What brought on the attack? And if I told them, no one around here would believe it. Oh, what do they know of these occult matters? Blind fools.
Kay, I think it's about time I talk to you frankly. We're not blind and we're not fools. We're just plain, sensible people that refuse to be fooled by a lot of supernatural nonsense.
Nonsense?
Exactly. There's no magic in dried lizards and dead chickens.
Ever since you met this Count Alucard in Budapest, you've changed. I hardly know you.
Kay, let me take you away from all this morbid business. A 6 months honeymoon, a year if you like. We won't come back here until you've overcome some of these strange ideas.
I'm sorry.
Sorry? Does that mean you're breaking our engagement?
Oh, no. You mustn't even think that.
Then what is it, Kay? There must be some reason.
Of course there's a reason, Frank. Since we were kids, there's never been anyone in my heart but you. You know that. But, well, don't ever doubt me, Frank. No matter what happens, believe in me. Believe that what I'm doing is best for us both.
Catherine tells Frank to never doubt how much she loves him, no matter what she does. She assures him it will always be in their best interest. Frank informs her he has had connections check into the Count's credentials and found the Hungarian government knew of no such Count. Their talk is interrupted by smoke coming from the Colonel's room.
They rush upstairs to find a small fire caused by the Colonel's cigar and the Colonel dead in his bed with a frightened look frozen on his face and two marks on his neck. Needless to say, the party breaks up some time after, but Dark Oaks has one more caller, Count Alucard, who demands to be announced, despite the family tragedy.
Later, Dr. Brewster places a call to a friend of his, a Hungarian professor named Laszlo at a nearby university. Laszlo comments that Alucard is not a Hungarian name, but they both know Dracula is, although Laszlo is certain that there is no Count Dracula among the living.
History says the last Count Dracula died in the Middle Ages. Why do you ask?
A certain Count Alucard is visiting a friend of mine. I happen to notice that the name spelled backward is Dracula. It made me curious.
That is strange. According to the legends of my people, the last Count Dracula became one of the undead. A vampire. And was finally destroyed in the 19th century. I am considered somewhat of an authority on the subject.
I know, Professor. That's why I called you. If this man is an imposter, why should he assume that name of all others?
Oh, he wouldn't, not if he was sane. In Transylvania, the name is associated only with evil. I advise you to be very careful of that man.
Well, from your tone, I gather you don't entirely disbelieve the legends of the former Dracula.
In my research, I have uncovered data which I cannot entirely disprove. I do not say I believe, but in honesty, I cannot say I disbelieve. I repeat, be very, very careful of that man.
I will, Professor.
At the reading of the Colonel's will, Catherine shows Judge Simmons a newer version that was written up shortly before her father's death. He, Frank, Claire, and Dr. Brewster are surprised to find it leaves the Colonel's fortune to Claire, but the plantation to Catherine and nothing else. Catherine says she wanted it that way, preferring not to divide Dark Oaks and sell it as she plans to live there forever. Frank intimates his fortune will take care of them financially, despite the fact that all the help have left in fear after the Colonel's mysterious death.
In private, Claire confides in Brewster that she doesn't believe Catherine will ever marry Frank. She suspects Catherine to be secretly meeting with Count Alucard. The two decide to snoop around the guest house to see if his belongings are still there. They find no trace of the two large chests, and when they open the trunks, they find there are no clothes or belongings inside. The two watch as Frank storms away from the main house, confirming Claire's suspicions about trouble in Paradise. A worried Brewster asks Claire to leave Dark Oaks and go back into town. He plans to ask Catherine to leave as well, and if she won't, he asks Claire to help him swear out an insanity complaint against her.
I don't like it, Claire.
I don't like it one bit. You've got to leave here and go back to town. And the sooner the better.
You sound as if I was in some kind of danger.
I'd rather not go into that, but I insist upon your leaving. You can go in with me and send for your things later.
I can't leave Kay alone. If I'm in danger, she must be too.
I'm going to make one last attempt to persuade her to leave. If she won't... Well, if she won't, I want you to join me in swearing out an insanity complaint against her.
An insanity complaint? Are you serious? Kay's my sister.
Claire, everybody's in danger here. Kay more than anyone else. If she won't leave voluntarily, then we've just got to force her.
Yes, but she'd be arrested, put in an asylum. I'd never do that to her.
Claire, don't you see? We've got to protect Kay from herself.
Later that night, Catherine leaves in her car, with Frank secretly following. She parks near the swamp and waits at its banks. A large chest slowly rises from the waters, and a strange mist begins to billow from under its lid. The mist coalesces into the form of Count Alucard, who then rides the chest like a fairy to the smiling form of Catherine. The Count kisses her hand as Frank pulls up some distance away, but close enough to see the two drive off together. Their destination is the home of Jonathan Kirby, Justice of the Peace, who they awaken for a midnight wedding. As they enter, a storm brews outside.
Back at Dark Oaks, the Count carries his bride across the threshold. The two discuss how their plans have come to fruition. Dark Oaks is now theirs. The Count likes her old house and the swamp in this young country full of life, unlike his desolate homeland. Catherine wants to know all the secrets of his people as the Count reassures her that they will have an eternity together. He goes in for the bite when a knock at the door interrupts them. It's Frank, who confesses he followed them, but lost them along the way. Catherine reveals that the two were married, and needless to say, Frank does not take it too well.
I told you not to come here again, Frank. I'm sorry.
Please, Kay, I've got to talk to you. Kay, I must know what this is all about. I know that you and Alucard are meeting secretly. I followed you tonight. I don't know where you went because I lost you, but...
We went to Mr. Kirby's. And we're married.
Married? No, no, you couldn't have.
I told you before, we were married tonight.
You'll save us all a lot of unpleasantness by going back to town with me tonight and taking the first train out in the morning.
I'm afraid I do not understand.
Then I'll make it clear. You're going back to town with me tonight. In the morning, you'll take the first train out. Kay will have the marriage annulled, and if you try to stop her or show up in this part of the country again, you'll be jailed.
The Count isn't one to take threats lightly and grabs Frank by the throat, tossing him like a baby through the doors and into the library. An enraged Frank pulls a pistol from his coat pocket. Alucard stands defiantly in the doorway while Catherine moves in to hide behind him. Frank fires directly at the Count, who never flinches. Catherine, however, drops to the ground behind him.
Bewildered, Frank calls out to her but gets no response. Frank fires two more times to no avail. He leaps out the window and runs off. He makes his way through the wooded acreage of the plantation while Alucard follows him in bat form. Frank finally collapses in the nearby cemetery and the bat lands on him, inching closer to his neck. Suddenly, the moon shines through a relief monument of a cross, projecting its sign on the ground near Frank's body. The bat retreats, assuming Alucard's form, who turns away from the holy symbol.
Dr. Brewster is reading up on Dracula when he hears a faint knock at his door. He finds a nearly catatonic Frank on the other side. At first, Frank can't remember how he came to be there. Then he frantically recalls how he shot through Alucard and killed Catherine, but he's unsure of what's real and what isn't. Brewster tries to calm him down, gives him a sedative, and then heads for Dark Oaks to see what really happened. Unbeknownst to the doctor as he pulls up, Alucard is busy filling a coffin with Dark Oak soil and placing Catherine's body inside. The Count notes Brewster's entrance and follows him into the basement. There, the doctor finds one of the missing chests full of dirt. His snooping is interrupted by the Count, who informs the good doctor he is now the master of Dark Oaks.
He takes the doctor upstairs and shows him to Catherine's bedroom, where he finds the bride glowing pale white, resting in an ornate nightgown.
Dr. Brewster, what on earth brings you here this time of night? I hope nothing's happened to Claire.
No. No, she was worried that something had happened to you.
I'm sorry. Count Alucard and I were married tonight.
Yes, so the Count told me.
It was the way we wanted it. Quiet and alone. That's the way we're going to live, Doctor.
You see, I'm engaged in some scientific research. It will take up all of our daylight hours.
And we'll have no time for social life.
We want you to explain this to Claire.
And to Frank. I'm fond of Frank. But of course, he must never come here again. I'd like you to tell all our friends not to come. If Judge Simmons has papers for us to sign, tell him to bring them in the evening.
Catherine is going to assist me in my research.
I see. Well, there doesn't seem to be any more for me to say, so if you'll pardon me, Catherine, I'll be leaving. Good night.
Goodbye, Doctor. And say goodbye to Frank.
Before the doctor leaves, the Count emphasizes his claim over the house and warns the doctor he will consider anyone who comes there without his permission a trespasser.
Brewster returns home, and while he and Judge Simmons discuss the insanity complaint they filed against Catherine, they receive a phone call telling them Frank has surrendered himself to the sheriff for the murder of Catherine. Brewster explains the events of last night to the sheriff, but he still insists on taking Frank to Dark Oaks and having a look for himself, despite the doctor informing him he won't find the Count and Countess at home. Brewster warns Sheriff Dawes that Frank has had a mental break and needs complete relaxation, but the sheriff reminds them all that he confessed to murder.
Dawes takes Frank, Brewster, Judge Simmons, and a deputy out to Dark Oaks. While Frank is trying to remember the events of the evening, Brewster checks the basement and finds the crate of earth he examined last night missing. The party moves on to the cemetery, where the sheriff takes note of a disturbed mausoleum. There he finds one of the long crates with Catherine dead inside. Frank breaks down, and the sheriff warns the doctor he has some explaining to do.
After a long day at the courthouse, Brewster returns home to find Professor Laszlo waiting for him. The two compare notes on the case, with Laszlo giving the professor a crash course in vampirism. The professor believes Alucard, who is undoubtedly a descendant of Dracula, must return to a grave with his native soil at dawn each day, and that is when he will be vulnerable. But he warns of how he can transform into a bat, a werewolf, and even a swirling mist. As if in answer, such a mist seeps under the doctor's office door while the two are plotting, and Count Alucard, or Dracula, reveals himself to them, defying them to stop him as he throttles the doctor.
You are very brilliant, aren't you, Professor Laszlo? Perhaps too brilliant for your own good and that of Dr. Brewster. You are right. I am here because this is a young and virile race. Not dry and decadent like ours. They have what I want, what I need, what I must have. Do you suppose that I would allow any mortal to stand in my way?
Professor Laszlo produces a small crucifix and backs the vampire away until he again becomes a mist and disappears.
Laszlo gives Brewster his cross to keep since Dracula has marked him for death. They both agree the entire town is in danger, and their fears are realized when Sarah lets in two of Brewster's patients, young Tommy Land and his mother. Brewster and Laszlo note the bite marks on the nearly unconscious boy's neck, corroborating the story he told his mother about a foreign man in a fog. Brewster draws tiny crosses over the wounds with iodine. Dr. Brewster is worried about Tommy becoming a vampire, but Laszlo informs him he would have to die from blood loss to rise as the undead. This confuses Brewster on why Laszlo thinks Catherine is a vampire, but Laszlo believes Catherine's morbid fascination with the occult and fear of death may have made her welcome the change. The two agree her body, too, must be destroyed, and set about to ask Claire to order it cremated. They head off to pick her up, since Frank is asking to see her.
Catherine has plans of her own and transforms into mist, escaping her coffin held in the morgue and making her way to Frank's cell in bat form. She lands on her sleeping ex and bites him and beckons him awake in her familiar form. Poor Frank struggles to grasp what he's hearing as Catherine tells him of her plans.
It is you. It is you, Kay, and you're alive. What is it, Kay? You seem to be cold like death. You seem to be Kay, but there's a strange difference. It's almost as if I didn't know you.
Does that mean you no longer love me?
I'll always love you.
Enough to spend the rest of your life with me.
But you're married, Kay. You're married to Alucard.
I don't love him, Frank. I never did.
But you're married to him.
I had to, Frank. It was part of the plan I told you about in the garden. I ask you to have faith in me then. I beg you to have faith in me now.
I don't understand.
Count Alucard is immortal. Through him, I attained immortality. Through me, you will do the same. And we will spend eternity together.
Are you serious? Do you expect me to believe anything so unreal?
How else can you explain the fact you shot through him without hurting him? How else could I be here?
Well, I can't explain it. It's so incredible.
Perhaps you'll understand when I tell you Count Alucard's real name is Count Dracula.
Count Dracula? You mean the Hungarian who's supposed to have been...
Don't use that word, Frank. We don't like it. Say rather that we are undead. Immortal.
Their talk is interrupted by Claire, who is the only one allowed to visit Frank while Brewster and Laszlo wait outside. The deputy on guard tells them of how he's heard Frank talking in two voices, both his own and that of a woman. Frank confides in Claire that he saw Catherine moments earlier, or at least he thinks he did. When she asks him about Alucard's whereabouts, Frank is suspicious of her motives. His suspicions turn into frantic ramblings when he discovers Claire intends to cremate Catherine, spouting off that she can't be destroyed now that she's attained immortality. The guard comes and removes Claire, and she, Laszlo, and Brewster leave.
Catherine materializes in Frank's cell once more, having heard about their cremation plans. She tells Frank they may have to eliminate both Brewster and her sister, which horrifies Frank. She then tells him where he can find Dracula during the day at the drainage flue near the edge of the swamp. She tells him she will help him escape so that he can put an end to the count. She tells Frank to meet her later in her and Claire's playroom at Dark Oaks, then changes into a mist who plans to open Frank's cell and bring him a gun.
Brewster and Laszlo see Catherine off, and Laszlo confides he believes Catherine did indeed visit Frank in his cell. He also reveals he is onto her plan to change her lifetime love, Frank, into a vampire so they can spend eternity together. Brewster has a hard time believing Frank would go along with it, but when they re-enter the courthouse, they run into Frank, armed with a gun and on the run. The sheriff's men pursue him as he steals a parked car, while Dawes, Brewster, and Laszlo see to Mac, who Frank knocked out. Mac tells him what he overheard, including where the count is spending his days. Before they head off, they convince the sheriff that strange things were afoot by showing him Catherine's coffin and body are now gone from the morgue.
On the Dark Oaks estate, Frank races to the drainage tunnel. There he finds the count's coffin hidden under dried moss but empty. He takes the moss and shoves it inside while the count arrives outside. Racing out of the tunnel, Frank runs right into Dracula.
It is seldom that my enemies are so accommodating. How did you learn where to find me?
And all about you. You're not Count Alucard, but Count Dracula. One of the undead, a loathsome thing. Surviving on the blood of the living. Well, there'll be no more blood of the living for you. Because I'm going to destroy you.
If you had learned more about me, you wouldn't have come here until after sunrise. Now it is not I that is going to be destroyed.
He backs Frank down the tunnel deeper and deeper, but Frank doesn't seem frightened and smiling the whole time. It's not just madness, it's confidence. And Dracula learns why when he sees his coffin ablaze.
What are you?
He throws Frank aside and attempts to put it out, but is unable to go near it. He grabs Frank and pleads with him repeatedly to put the fire out, even throwing him into it, but Frank does nothing but pass out from the experience. The Count even tries to put it out by ripping a loose board from the tunnel, but to no avail. Frustrated, he grabs Frank's body and begins to choke the life out of him until he notices the sun rising over the trees. He shrinks from the rays and falls into the swamp waters near his coffin, his body dissolving into a skeleton.
Frank runs off just as Dawes, Brewster, and Laszlo arrive at the drainage tunnel and discover Dracula's burning coffin and skeletal remains. The sheriff is still having a hard time buying all this, but either way, he still has to bring Frank to trial, whether Brewster's and Laszlo's testimonies can help him escape conviction or not. Frank, meanwhile, has entered Dark Oaks and in Catherine's old playroom finds her body resting in her coffin. He looks longingly at her and places his ring upon her finger.
Brewster, Laszlo, and Dawes soon arrive and find Frank walking from the playroom, which is engulfed in flames. They enter to see the room and the coffin afire. They bear witness as Frank stares blankly in resigned contentment.
Okay, so I like the opening titles of this film. You see mysterious hands wiping away the cobwebs and dust and spooky fonts. And yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. The movie starts out with Frank and Dr. Brewster, you know, there to pick up the Count. And that's awful nice of them, you know, they're just, you know, I mean, Frank's the fiance, but it's kind of, you know, he's the fiance picking up this guy that is his fiance is hosting, you know.
So, yeah, it's kind of good.
Yeah, yeah. But Dr. Brewster is apparently really close to the family, as we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's all up in their business.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. So, Robert Page, who plays Frank, had a varied career in Hollywood, from leading men roles in standard fare comedies and even as a singing lead in several musicals. He later went into television, often emceeing programs, and wound up as a newscaster for ABC due to his rich baritone voice. He made several films with his fiance here, Louise Albrighton, or the actress that played his fiance here. They were engaged. And appeared with two fellow Universal Monster Fighters in Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. Frank Craven is best known for playing the role of Mr. Morgan, the stage manager, in both the original Broadway and film productions of Our Town. He even adapted the story into the film screenplay. He wrote, directed, and produced many Broadway plays and wrote several other screenplays. He was often typecast as the wise small-town elder with a dry sense of humor, like here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the film where we first get the name of Alucard.
And it's used ad nauseum. Holy crap.
Yep, it's used over and over in other Dracula stories from Dell Comics' infamous superhero Dracula series where his secret identity is Alucard. It's Al Ulysses Card, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
To Dracula 80, 1972's Johnny Alucard. I know that's your favorite.
Mm-hmm.
To the Monster Squad, where Dracula leaves a message for the lead character as Alucard. So I wonder why Alucard's traits are so heavy.
I don't know. You know, when they're full of Earth, you know.
And him.
Yeah.
So then we meet both Catherine and Claire, the Caldwell sisters. Note Catherine's shroud-like drapey gown, which paints her as almost ghostly-like, obsessed with death and the occult.
Oh, I know. And any time that she walks, it, you know, kind of flows behind her, you know, very, you know, wrathy-like.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice look. She's definitely into it. She's a goth girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a goth girl of the 40s. So we get right off the bat, you know, she's rather strange. And clearly not like her sister Claire.
Mm-mm.
And it's amazing how they set up with their differences just in a short exchange between the two of them. I mean, this is really economical writing and acting, but it paints the picture of the characters really well. She's got this strange, dark way about her. She seems somewhat vampiric from the start due to her dark hair. And she's got this detached demeanor about her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's... You know, in the clothes, of course, but they really do a good job. Both the actress and the writing do a good job of portraying this character because the whole plot hinges on her, obviously. Louise Albrighton only made 24 films in total. She studied at the Pasadena Playhouse. Most of her films were under contract at Universal, and she married news correspondent Charles Collingwood 3 years after this film and retired. So a lot of actresses back then married and retired.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, you know, but I guess that's kind of the way it used to be. If it was a working woman when she got married,
then she quit.
She often retired back then. So, of course, Evelyn Ankers is no stranger to this show or anyone who knows their Universal monster films. Undoubtedly most famous as the love interest Gwen Conliff opposite Chaney in The Wolfman. She also appeared with him in Ghost of Frankenstein and one of the Inner Sanctum movies, Weird Woman, despite the fact they openly despised each other. She also appeared in The Invisible Man's Revenge, The Mad Ghoul, and Captive Wild Woman for the studio. She is Universal's reigning screen queen for many.
There you go.
Especially of this period. So if you are obsessed with the cult, what better than having your own live-in crone on your property?
So
what did you think of Queen Zimba?
I wish we had seen more of her. Because, I mean, it was just a one little short scene. I wish that she had been more of that, you know?
Yeah.
So that, I think it was a really good hook. And I was like, wait, they killed her off. You know, she was on screen for like 2 minutes.
Yeah. I think her line, "I see you marrying a corpse," that could have been the title of this movie, "I Married a Corpse."
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a Val Lewton film, which this film has some common traits with. So, like the body snatcher and cat people and things like that. And I walked with a zombie. I mean, I married a corpse, I walked with a zombie, you know. Zimba is played by Adeline DeWalt Reynolds, who began her Hollywood career at age 78, just a few years before this.
Dang.
So this role wasn't much of a stretch for her. She probably just pulled out her dentures. You know? So she fills in the Maliva-like role here.
Maliva.
Not Velveeta.
Maliva.
Not Motorola or whatever, yeah.
I never said Motorola. Snot.
But she doesn't have the steely nerves of Maliva because, Dracula in bat form manages to scare her to death. So,
yep.
What do you think about the bat in this film?
Considering it was in 1943, very well done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's actually better than some of the Bats in the Hammer movies, which are 20 plus years later. So, yeah, I thought they did an excellent job. It's one of the better, definitely one of the better bat puppets. And it does more bat-like things than just fly around, and we'll see. At the Count's reception, we get to finally see Lon Chaney Jr. as Alucard or Dracula or whatever, whoever the hell he is. More on that later. We've covered Chaney's career in depth, featuring him on every House of Frankenstein. This is where he gets to check off the last of the four major Universal monsters off his play card. He owned the Wolfman lock, stock, and barrel, only actor to portray him. He also played the Frankenstein monster, had three goes at the Mummy, and here he's Count Dracula. So he's the only actor to play all four.
I wonder if he gets free lunch at the commissary.
Yeah. Well, he was usually making lunch for everybody else.
Uh-huh.
He often would like cook chili and stuff and fed everybody, you know. So
there you go.
Yeah. Catherine tells her father good night, and you get no indication she knows he is going to die as part of her plot.
I know.
She even blows him a kiss.
Mm-hmm.
That's cold. I mean, wow.
I mean,
stone cold.
Yes.
She loves Frank. That's about it.
As we later find out.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Oof. We get the first on-screen transformation of a vampire into a bat in this film. And the first one isn't quite as impressive as some of the later ones in the film. Chaney just backs his black cape into the camera, and then the bat flies away from the camera.
Right.
But it works. You know, it's actually better than the Superman movie serials where Kirk Allen would just turn into an animated Superman all of a sudden. What doesn't work is the fact that you see both the bat puppet and Chaney reflected in the hallway mirror.
Mm-hmm.
But they also did that in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, so. When Catherine and Frank have their talk outside, we learn a lot about both of them, but it doesn't seem like too much of an info dump. They have been in love since they were kids, and Catherine has apparently changed, becoming obsessed with the occult after a trip to Hungary, where she met Alucard and brought Zimba back with her. So, we get all of that right here. And we get the first hint of Catherine's plan, where she, You know, when she tells Frank to never doubt her. Now, if I got obsessed with some phony foreign countess and brought back some mumbo-jumbo crone, what would you think or do?
You're a nutter. Get off your nut.
The engagement's off. So, do you think Alucard tried to make it look like the colonel died from asphyxiation with the fire, or was he just really sloppy and let him drop the cigar?
I don't know. I mean, I really think when you, looking back, you know, we know how the movie ends now and everything else. To me, this is a whole thing. I think he actually, the Count actually wanted Catherine, wanted to be married to her, you know, everything else. She played him.
Of course, yeah.
And it's one of those cases that I don't know if he, I don't know.
I definitely get the feeling that he was completely sincere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that, you know, he wouldn't get the Dracula wandering eye and end up with a couple other brides. Because, you know, Dracula likes to have his, you know,
harem.
His harem of brides, as we know. He definitely buys in. But I just wonder, because the doctor says, you know, well, I don't think he died of asphyxiation, but they didn't know Dr. Brewster was going to be there, or he didn't. Now, Catherine probably would have, because Dr. Brewster's apparently at everything they do, as we'll get to. Frank and the staff stomp on the fire for what seems like a minute before one of them is smart enough to grab the drapes and put it out.
Like, bless
just,
them.
Just stick your feet in the fire, guys. It's a good idea.
Well, I mean, you know, even later, I mean, they do not know basic fire cessation. You know, Alucard, here, let me throw a board into it.
Fire bad.
Come on.
You're adding fuel, dude, literally. Yeah.
Jumping ahead, sorry.
Now, it's worth pointing out that the servants in this film are all African-American, which was probably appropriate for the time in the South. I mean... While this could have been seen, while this could be seen as a problem today, they are treated better than many of their peers in films of this time. There's only one stereotypical wide-eyed scare take, and that's from the guy who receives Alucard at the door, and a white character does the same thing later.
Right.
So it's not, I mean, it's not like the Three Stooges shorts, you know.
No.
Kind of,
very cringy.
Yeah, very cringy now, yeah. If there was a ride, if there was a Son of Dracula ride at Universal, they wouldn't have to change it like they're having to do Splash Mountain.
Right.
You know, basically. So, this Dracula isn't interested in winning them over with charm like Lugosi before or Carradine after him. He's letting his title do the work. He can be as much of an ass as he wants.
Announce Count Alucard. Explain that I came by motor and was delayed.
I'm sorry, sir, but Colonel Caldwell died tonight, and the family isn't receiving.
Announce me.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. He's like, announce me! You know.
Oh, but, yeah.
I'm sorry, sir. Colonel Caldwell passed away tonight, and they're not receiving guests. Announce me! You know, just like.
He wants what's due him.
Yeah.
You know, or what he views as being due him.
Right, yeah. One of my favorite things about this film is no one is an idiot. Dr. Brewster noted the name Alucard in the crest right from the start, and once he sees two bite marks and has a mysterious death on his hands, he's on the phone to an expert. We even get a scene where he's writing it out on a piece of paper and turning it in case the audience was either really dense or really young.
Yeah.
You know, so.
It's like, let's figure this out, kids.
Yeah. That expert is played by J. Edward Bromberg, who I just talked about with Rob and Max last month on the Film and Water episode on the Mark of Zorro during Zorro month. He played the alcalde, Luis Quintero, which you watched the Mark of Zorro with
mm-hmm,
me.
Yeah.
So when we were watching it, I didn't even realize it was the same guy.
Yeah.
It hit me later. I'm like, oh yeah, it's him. It's, you know, so yeah. After a prosperous and respected film and stage career, he was one of many actors and filmmakers caught up in the Red Scare witch hunt of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Refusing to answer their questions, he was blacklisted and left the U.S. for stage work in England, where the pressures led to failing health and a fatal heart attack at age 47. I know. There was a whole lot of creative folks in Hollywood who ended up on the wrong end of that bullshit, so... So do we think that Colonel actually signed that will, or did Catherine fake it? You know, she produces this. Oh, well, there's a newer will.
Uh-huh.
So now the judge says, you know, that it looks completely legit. But, you know, she did have Queen Zimba staying with
and
her.
And were she was interested into the occult herself, could she have hypnotized her father?
Right.
And, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an unfair division of the property. I mean, basically, she just wants Dark Oaks. Because she plans.
And what about the name Dark Oaks? Let's talk about that. I'm like, holy crap. Why don't you just say, vampires live here? You know?
I mean, even Collinwood's called Collinwood. It's not called Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
But Dark Oaks.
Dark
Oaks. Come on.
It's a great name, though, for a.
Telegraph it.
I mean, since the Haunted Mansion out in Disneyland's actually, you know, a southern plantation,
mm-hmm.
and it's supposed to be in New Orleans, which they never say it's in New Orleans, but I kind of assume it's in
I
thought it was super
I think they did say Louisiana.
Okay, well, they might be, but it's definitely
I might be wrong, but I think they said Louisiana at some point.
It's definitely in within somewhere along the Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
down
that
south.
Era.
Yeah.
I mean, that area.
That area. And so since the Haunted Mansion, I mean, the Haunted Mansion could be called Dark Oaks,
yeah.
You know, honestly. So, yeah. But, yeah, it, you know, it's not cut and dry because it's not, she's not like screwing Claire over.
No, she's not.
So it might have been legit, but she apparently talked him into it. But now here, why is Dr. Brewster at the reading of this will?
Well, because he might have been attesting to his sound mind and body. He might have been the countersign on that.
Mm, that's true.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. You know,
so that might be what was going on there.
It almost seems like.
And especially where her father was in a wheelchair.
Mm.
So that might have been.
Well, that's true. That's
true. I mean,
true.
You know.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah. It almost seems weird, though. It almost seems like he is like a second father to Claire, like she's his ward or something. Because he orders her around quite a bit.
Well, depending on her age at the time, if she was under the age of 25, he might have been her ward.
Well, they said that the will that they started out reading was written when she became of age.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but maybe she was at one time.
And you, I mean, even at that time, you got to think that it could have been at the age of 21 or 25, which was your typical coming of age for a woman, whereas a boy was typically considered coming of age at 21, mm-hmm. and a woman was 25.
Okay.
Was typical.
Okay. It just seems like there's more of a connection between them. Judge Simmons is played by Samuel S. Hines, who is best known for playing George Bailey's father in It's a Wonderful Life and Dr. Kildare's father in that series of films, but he also played a judge in the Karloff Lugosi thriller The Raven for Universal.
Mm.
Claire tells Brewster she can't imagine Catherine marrying Alucard because there was something repugnant about him. I get that she's talking more than just about his attitude.
Yeah.
I think they are trying to imply the older vampire legends are there being something repulsive about the undead that they can't hide. I don't know if it's odor or bad breath or...
Or just like, you know, the heebie-jeebies. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's people that give me the heebs and then you find out later that, you know...
There's a reason they gave me the heebs.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely something because the way the servant reacted to him... The way the Justice of the Peace reacts to him later. And, I mean, there's not, like, any kind of, like, extreme makeup. He looks like Lon Chaney with a pencil-thin mustache and his hair slicked back.
I wish I had a pencil-thin mustache, the Boston Blackie kind, two-tone.
Yeah, which he
I'm
had.
I'm sorry every time you say that.
Yeah, which he had at the time, yeah. The first time I saw this, I figured Dr. Brewster would be the wise old man who informs the younger characters about his suspicions, but not straight up, you know, our fill-in Van Helsing here. But he is, because he breaks into Alucard's things.
Yep. He tells Claire what to do.
Yeah, tells her what to do. And he even goes so far to threaten an insanity complaint against Catherine. So, mm-hmm. now he's straight up, well, him and Laszlo both are like, the two Van Helsings,
mm-hmm.
in this film. So what did you think of the Count's big reveal in the swamp when he's surfing on his...
I know, I can't... mean,
coffin surfing.
Yeah.
But it is pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a really, there's this, the music swells and, you know, the coffin and the special effects with the mist coalescing into him is really, really well done.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Although you did point out it calls into the question the old vampire weakness of running water.
I know. I mean, you know, but a lot of the rules for vampires aren't necessarily followed here because, you know, like you have Catherine using soil from Dark Oaks. Why isn't it the soil of Transylvania that he's sharing with her? I mean, I know it's her homeland.
It's her native soil, though.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, how would... What would you do as far as, is it considered your soil from where you're at? Or what if you have somebody that was born in another country and they're here? Do they have to go back to their homeland to get their soil if they're turned into a vampire? I mean, you know, I'm confused.
It's like getting a passport or something.
I mean, you know, it just...
That's a good question. Well, and I think the whole running water thing is negated a bit because, one, he never tries to... He's on the coffin the whole time. He doesn't cross it himself. He's crossing it over something. And we obviously know Dracula can cross running water like in a ship because he did in the Demeter in the book.
Right.
You know, so, yeah. And in most film versions. So, yeah. But, yeah, the mist effects, you know, this is there's a lot of mist in this one. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of them. It's really well done. The guy behind it goes uncredited, but the effects were provided by one of Universal's most reliable artisans, that's John P. Fulton, most famous for creating the convincing effects of all the Invisible Man films.
Okay.
So he knows his stuff, you know. So it really looks great. I mean, I honestly don't think they could do a better job of that type of thing in a modern movie, really. The Count and Kay are, you know, the Justice of the Peace, get mm-hmm. married. He brings her back to Dark Oaks, and this is where Catherine admits she had this plan all along. Like, they never spell it out that it involved killing her father, but obviously it did, as, you know, they would still have to deal with him owning Dark Oaks.
Right, right.
So, yeah. The Count's tale of his land having soil red with the blood of 100 races is a nice touch, and it calls back to why Dracula left for England in the novel. He's just moved on to America here.
Right, it's just better hunting grounds.
Right, right, right.
As we planned. This house is ours. No one else has any claim on it.
I like old houses. I like your countryside and the swampland.
It's very different from your homeland.
That is why I like it. My land is dry and desolate. The soil is red with the blood of 100 races. There is no life left there. Here, you have a young and vital race.
You've spoken of your people, but I want to know more. Their legends, their mystery, their gifts.
Perhaps someday we may return there. As I have told you, my dear, ours will be a different life. Without material needs. A life that will last through eternity.
It sounds like Catherine has gotten a quick pamphlet on vampirism, but not the full brochure at this point. And, of course, you're about to make out and someone comes to the door.
Yeah.
It's always the way.
Right? Yeah, I know. Or your daughter comes down the hallway and you're like, damn it.
Sandy. Oh, brother. What do you think about the Count tossing Frank around?
I mean, you know, Lon Chaney has a reputation for throwing him around. And I mean, you know, you're showing his physical prowess that way.
Yeah. Of course, we know Chaney is a famous brawler, like you said. And I have no doubt he really could toss a guy around like this. But he's also very controlled here. You know, he just grabs him in anger, but then he just shoves him away in the room. And apparently this is the first time a vampire is shown to have superior strength on film.
Okay.
And how about Catherine getting shot through him?
This is what kills me. You know, you've always seen Dracula is always shown as a ladies' man, and always, you know, he's being shown, especially with Lugosi's portrayal and stuff, that he's a romantic and, you know, da 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 da. And here he's just like, she's gonna get shot. Oh well, you know, it hurt, I'm sure. And he doesn't give a crap that she's getting shot. I mean, I know he was getting ready to kill her, but himself by biting her, but he just lets her get shot and die.
I didn't get that he realized she got behind him, though, really. That's what I got. I just, you know, he was just so intent on, you know, go ahead and shoot me, dude. He didn't realize that Catherine was going to be stupid enough to hide behind him. You know, she could have ran out of the house.
But the thing is, though, is Frank says, Catherine, and he doesn't even turn around.
Well, he figures I can fix this, you know. She's going to die. You know, she's got to die to make this work anyway. And we'll get into that in a little bit because there were, you know, he didn't get to buy her. So we'll get into that in a minute. You mentioned.
I couldn't help it when he's down on the floor and stuff like that. He looks so much like Jim Neighbor's Gomer Pyle. I started going, golly.
Golly, I done killed her. I done shot her. Andy, you're going to have to arrest me. Shazam. Oh, Ange, I think Gomer done killed Catherine. We got to nip it in the bud.
Okay, honey, move on.
Oh, sorry. I like the look Chaney gives him as he continues to try and oppose him. And, you know, Paige angrily fires his gun in a way that it seems to be coming out of him, not the pistol. He's like, you know, I can't do it. You can't see me doing it. But it's just, he moves his arm every time. He's like, he's literally like he's slinging the bullets out of him.
Yeah.
And it still doesn't do anything. I'm not sure, you know, he jumps out the window and he runs through the woods. And he lands near this cross and then, you know, the bat, which again looks good. And when it lands on him, it's crawling up him. It looks like a bat actually crawls. It's really pretty effective. But I'm not sure the moonlight would come through the cross quite that way. I mean, it looks like somebody's shining the cross signal, you know, basically.
I know, because, I mean, you know, the way the cross would have to be positioned would have to be, you know, more on a horizontal versus a vertical.
I think it'd been more effective if they just showed him in a bunch of shadows and in the middle there was no shadow in the shape of a cross. Something. But here it looks like it's lit up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's there to sell the point.
I know, it sells the point, but at the same time, I don't know if it would have been physically possible for that to happen.
Yeah, it does remind me a bit of the windmill, the shadow of the windmill working in Brides of Dracula later.
Right.
So, Frank shows up at Dr. Brewster's house, and Paige continues, he does a great job of showing just how frantic and unnerved Frank is. And a lot of these films, these type of characters just shrug off the supernatural way too easily. But Frank is totally broken here.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just, you know, not only has he apparently killed the love of his life, but he's seen things that shouldn't be possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's clearly distressed.
Harry, I've killed Kay. It's all mixed up, but I know I shot her twice. Harry, am I insane? Could I have shot through Alucard and killed her without hurting him? Tell me what happened. Well, I shot right through him. As Kay screamed and fell, and he just stood there. Just stood there staring at me. Just staring at me. You don't believe that, do you?
I think of, you know, not to pick on it, but the 31 Dracula with Lugosi where, you know, David Manners is like, they're discussing that, you know, Mina's been bitten. He's like, oh, Dracula, what has he done to you? You know, I mean, it's just like, it's like, oh, you stubbed your toe? Oh, honey, I'm sorry. You know, that type, you know, it's like, no, he's like playing it. It's like, he's like wringing his hands through his hairs. It's like, I shot her. You know, it's just, I mean, he's like freaking out. So it's really well done. So we see Alucard is placing Catherine into a coffin. Since we know she rises as a vampire, did he bite her post-mortem? I know we're going to get into that with what Laszlo says. So do you think, I mean, is it just because she was so strange and into the occult?
Or was she only mostly dead?
Was she only mostly dead? You know, and we'll get to that when Laszlo talks about it in a little bit, but it just, it's brings it up this time and then it brings it up again later. And they don't really come out and tell you, so. So Queen Zimba had chickens, which are usually associated with voodoo. But now we find caged chickens in the basement when Dr. Brewster goes snooping around in there, along with chicken feathers in the Count's coffin. This is something totally unique to this film.
I don't know.
That part I don't get. Yeah. There's some spooky theremin music here and there when we see the Count sneak into the house earlier and also here in the basement. It's a bit on the nose for modern audiences. I mean, it sounds like something you'd, you know, like that's, you know, stereotypical theremin spooky music. But I think it works because of the shadowy atmosphere of the film, and it works well with the rest of the score. It's by frequent Universal composer Hans J. Salter, and you can hear samples of some of his other scores here, like The Wolfman, but apparently much of this is lifted from his and Frank Skinner's Seven Sinners film score, which I'm not familiar with, but they like to recycle music a lot at Universal. Once it was in the library, it was fair game.
Yeah.
And they just edited it together, however. What did you think about the reveal of Catherine in bed? I mean, we just saw her dumped in a coffin.
Well, like I said, I think they consummated the marriage.
Mm.
Because that way there's not any, you know, you can't say that the marriage can be annulled because it's been consummated. And I think because as, you know, weird as she was and as committed as she was to this, I think she'd have done it.
Mm. Well, at least they couldn't come out and say that in 1933.
No, 43, right.
But her lying in bed did indicate that
the deed had been done.
Yeah, exactly. She's very pale, and she never really looks directly at the doctor. It's as if she's in a trance, even though this was her plot. This is the one of the few times Alucard seems actually in control in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite a switch for Dracula. I think, you know, in that case, he's like, okay, you let me handle this. I'll coach you through it.
Well, she's, you know, just risen from the dead.
Yeah, she's new. You know, she's you know, just got her intermediate vampire card, you know. So, the judge, when Dr. Brewster and the judge talk later, he mentions Catherine was like a niece to him. These girls were very popular in town, apparently. They're mm-hmm. all the nieces and wards and blah, 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 are seeming wards of just about every authority figure in town. I do like, though, you know, they go to the police station, and the doctor's like, oh, I'm telling you, I saw Catherine, and I saw Alucard, and they're both fine, and I think Frank's just out of his mind, and he's like, the sheriff's basically, I don't care who he is or how much money he's got, I'm going to investigate this.
Yes.
Because the dude came in and says, I killed somebody.
Yes.
And, you know, the good old boy policy isn't going to help Frank, apparently, which I like to see. Usually yeah. be like, oh, well, if you say so, doctor, it's fine, you know. Pat Moriarty, who plays the sheriff, is probably best known for this film, The Devil and Miss Jones, and King's Row, a film starring Ann Sheridan, Robert Cummings, and some guy named Ronald Reagan. This movie... Bear with me for a minute. This movie was the one Reagan was filming when Catwoman attempted to kill him under orders from Ian Carcool. The future president was saved by Batman and Robin in the epic All-Star Squadron Annual number 3. So, there you go.
If you say so.
Because the whole deal of that story was Carcool figured out who was going to be president of the United States, the different presidents,
mm-hmm.
and he showed up where they were and attempted to kill him. And the JSA had to show up and stop him. And Green Lantern actually didn't save one kid.
Yeah.
So that changed the course of history. Who was it? Don't know. So. But anyway. From IMDb. Now you'll love this. While filming Son of Dracula, Louise Albright and her co-star Robert Page were constantly playing jokes on their castmates. One day, co-star Pat Moriarty and Robert Page were filming a scene where they flip open Albrighton's character's coffin. They were astonished upon opening the lid to find Albrighton inside completely naked.
Woohoo! So, you know, that's on film somewhere.
It probably is, yeah. Wowza. So her coffin is one of the crates, but the Count made sure to line hers like a coffin. You know, it's all plush inside, fabric, yeah. And it's real nice. So that's how you treat a lady.
Oh, there you go. Alrighty.
Yeah. You think Alucard would have been smart enough to hide the coffin in a less obvious place, you know, like not the mausoleum, or at least locked it, you know? It's like...
Well, by the same token, though... You know, you get the idea that where he came and shot her, he was probably moving quickly and didn't, you know,
yeah,
they didn't have time to do things like they probably would have.
Right, right, right. The scene in the doctor's office is one of my favorites in the film. Not only do we get the classic vampire lore class we almost always get from a vampire hunter expert, we actually get the vampire to show up and interrupt
him. That was cool. When he came through, I thought, ooh!
Yeah, yeah. It's like, oh crap, you talking smack about me?
Yeah! What?
It's here Laszlo states that he believes Alucard is a descendant of Dracula. He's Count Dracula, but not necessarily the Count Dracula. Although folks have debated for years if he's meant to be Stoker's character or not. The son of title kind of makes sense in this regard. He is not necessarily Dracula's direct son, but he's a son of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, Dracula means son of the dragon. So, there you go.
I don't know.
So, did Dracula stop by and bite Tommy for a snack before he came to Brewster's?
You know, he's a little peckish.
It's like, hey kid, come here.
Yeah, a little peckish.
Yeah.
Need a little nap.
Yeah.
Not nap, nibble, excuse me.
Yeah, showing that he's low enough to feed on children really paints the picture that the entire town is in danger, though.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Joan Bates, who goes uncredited as Miss Land, was also uncredited in Citizen Kane. So there you go, Rob Kelly, if you're listening. So, some interesting discussion about Catherine.
Well, what about Kay? She died from bullet wounds, and yet you implied that she would become a vampire?
Yes, but her case was different. Her background was...
I know, morbid. She'd gone overboard on the subject of the supernatural, black magic and the like.
Exactly. And I rather believe that Miss Caldwell may have made the transition from choice.
No one could choose a thing so loathsome.
Don't forget, the girl was morbid. That often means thanatophobia, fear of death. And Alucard could promise her eternal life.
Eternal life at such a price?
Vampire folklore often had it that wicked people or those who dabbled in black magic would rise as vampires after their death. It didn't take the bite of another vampire to do so. So this is pulling in older folklore that's normally not associated with modern vampire film mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. Now, Catherine did learn quick. She turns into a mist and a bat on her first night. So she, you know, she had her intermediate card, but, you know.
Well, but then, you know, she'd been in contact with Alucard and stuff like that.
And Queen Zimba. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Then she has quite an info dump, but again, it doesn't seem really forced. Part of this is how cool and detached Albrighton remains. She has this languid, death-like cadence that is literally as calm as the grave when mm-hmm. she's talking to Frank. Yeah. Frank starts to call Dracula a vampire, and Catherine stops him because apparently that's an offensive term to them. They prefer undead or immortal. Who knew?
You know.
We don't like that. She tells him.
Yeah,
I can say that, but you can't say that. You know, that's
that's right.
This movie really emphasizes that need to return to the native soil each night. That's often just given as lip service, but it's rarely a huge part of the plot. But here, it's very, very important, as we shall soon see.
Again, like I said, you know, I want to know how you determine what's your home soil there.
Yeah.
You know, because what if you're born in another country and you come, or you're across the country? I mean, do you have to go back and get your soil? Is it where you're born or where you're turned vampire, or how that's all?
What if you're a little foggy? It's like, well, you know, I grew up in Kentucky. I'm from Kentucky. And it's like, you know, it's like, well, he burned up in the sunlight when he was trying to get to his coffin. Wonder what happened. And then his daddy's like, well, that boy was born in Indiana. He wasn't born in Kentucky.
You know, think about, you know, Abraham Lincoln, born in Kentucky, but moved to Illinois.
Yep. Yeah. And we always, who gets to claim Lincoln?
Yeah.
Well, Illinois land of Lincoln, but we got Lincoln's birthplace here. So
Yeah. So, you know.
That's right.
Which is actually a pretty good book that doesn't fall apart until the last fourth.
Yeah, the last chapter, really.
Well, you know.
I still haven't watched the movie, but I
don't. It's pointless.
Yeah, I heard the movie.
Oh, it bites.
And not in a good way.
Yeah. But anyway, I digress. Sorry.
Yeah. I get the impression Brewster and Laszlo didn't inform Claire about everything, and she is pretty surprised to hear Frank saw Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they were not surprised, but so. Paige continues to really make a meal out of this role. He vacillates between lucidity and franticness at the drop of the hat, which is a perfectly reasonable interpretation of what this guy is being put through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's poor dude. I mean, geez. Walter Sandy, who plays Mac, the deputy on guard, is a familiar face, having appeared in To Have and Have Not, Bad Day at Black Rock, and he played Paul Revere in Disney's Johnny Tremaine, which we watched not that long ago.
Yeah.
And that's where they get the Liberty Tree Tavern at Disney World where we like to eat.
Yes, especially you.
Yeah, especially me. Yeah. Well, Catherine already killed her father, so she's not too broken up if she has to kill her sister.
She is no sister to me.
Yeah, again. Cold.
Yeah, I'm just like, dang. Yeah.
The missed effect of Catherine going out of the cell is really well done, especially because Paige is in the shot the whole time. Yeah. Frank's in the shot the whole time. So, now, I get how Catherine was able to get Frank a gun, but how did she get her coffin moved out of the morgue and in the Dark Oaks?
I don't know.
Even for a vampire, this seems a stretch. I know she's strong, but wouldn't you notice a woman in a chiffon evening gown carrying a coffin over her head at least 10 miles out of town?
I don't know. Just let it go.
I know.
Maybe there was another coffin. Maybe there's two. I don't know.
I don't think so, but okay. Good on Frank for taking that dried moss and shoving it into the crate. That's how you start a fire.
That's right.
All
right.
So, Dracula's bat transformation at the end is nice. They don't try to show his face change. They just show the bat and Dracula from the back, but it works really well. So, that's a really good one. And now we get the final confrontation with Dracula. It's rare that Dracula is so duped throughout a movie, but Frank is not afraid of him as he approaches.
No.
He's already destroyed him as far as he's concerned. He honestly doesn't care if he kills him, probably, at this point. Chaney has played Dracula very cool and reserved for the most part, but when he sees that coffin ablaze, he loses it and goes into full-on frantic Larry Talbot mode.
Yep.
Even roughing up poor Robert Page like only Lon Chaney can do.
Well, the thing is, though, is he, you know, he gets so frantic that he's like, help me, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, he's trying to kill you. I really don't think he's going to help
you. Yeah.
Just don't think that's going
to
happen.
He seems to throw the stuntman playing Frank right into the fire at one point. It doesn't seem planned, but because it sure doesn't look very safe. But
right.
I guess the guy's okay. The effect of his hand dissolving is really nice. We see Dracula's ring on his hand, and then it dissolves, and it's still on the skeleton. So that's really well done. So Frank wasn't quite as insane or as controlled by Catherine as she believes. So what he did took a lot of nerve, despite it being the right thing to do, because, I mean, clearly this was a hard thing for the character to do. But you have to imagine, this guy's never going to be right again.
Oh, no.
I mean, the way Paige plays it, it's...
I really thought when he comes out and sees them coming up into the attic or playroom or whatever, I thought he was going to walk back in there with her and just burn up with her.
Jump into the flames.
Yeah, I really thought that's how it was going to end.
Yeah, but you got to wonder, is he going to be convicted of any of this?
Right.
I mean, will he get off on an insanity plea? I mean, you know, they're going to have a hard time convincing other people. Well, I mean, Judge Simmons has been involved in this case, so it might help him.
Right.
But, you know, this is a very dark ending for a Universal film where at least someone, usually the lovebirds, escaped a horrible fate, even when they don't deserve to.
Right.
Like Henry Frankenstein both times.
Mm-hmm.
Guy didn't deserve to make it out, and he does, no. You know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, not that Catherine deserved to either, but it's a very dark ending. With its deep shadows and especially controlling femme fatale lead character pulling the strings of everyone, this feels very much like a film noir movie.
Mm-hmm.
Some have called it horror noir, and in that way,
I can buy that.
Yeah.
You know, as a genre title, yeah.
Yeah, it also feels, like I said, the closest Universal got to what Val Lewton was doing over at Republic. It's a much more adult story. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, shortly after this, the next Dracula movie is House of Dracula, and before that you have House of Frankenstein. And I mean, I love those movies. I love them. They're fun. But there's a goofy, childlike logic to them, you know? that just, I mean, all the brain swapping that doesn't even make sense.
Right.
You know,
right.
It doesn't even make sense. It's like, I'm going to put your brain in the brain of the wolf man into you and this and that and blah, blah, blah and all that stuff. It's like, this is a very adult, you know, I mean, not that the kids can't watch it, but it's in a storyline that the kids wouldn't necessarily be into beyond, ooh, monsters.
Right.
Of course, the story came from Kurt Siodmak, who was no stranger to infusing a lot of pathos into his stories like The Wolfman, but his brother Robert Siodmak, who directed this picture, would go on to direct much-hailed noir masterpieces as The Spiral Staircase, The Killers, and Dark Mirror. So, he's getting his start at that here.
I mean, this is not a happy ending film at
no,
all.
No, it's not.
By no stretch.
And, I mean, the lead monster, Dracula, is played as by a fool by Catherine.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he... This might be the start of Dracula as a sympathetic character.
In some ways, yeah.
I mean, you know, because I think, yes, he wanted to come and kill Americans, but at the same time, he came over here with the idea that he was going to love Catherine. You know,
just a guy that wanted to, you know, a mail order bride, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, why not? The real controversy over this movie wasn't Louisa Albright naked in her coffin, but the casting of Lon Chaney Jr. as Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
Because for years, many have decried he was miscast, with Universal only booking him on his name value as their horror star and not considering if he was right for the role. In recent times, I think many have come to regard his interpretation as valid, and his cold, seething demeanor is a change from the Dracula we saw from Lugosi and later Carradine. But I think, in a lot of ways, it's a bit closer to the novel's interpretation of Dracula as just a right bastard.
Right.
And not unsimilar to the powerful portrayal that Christopher Lee would later give, if quite a bit less visceral. I mean, he doesn't have bloody fangs and bloodshot eyes, but he's got that commanding presence because Lon Chaney's a big guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, he's got that kind of, when he walks in a room, you're like, oh, you know, crap.
Yeah.
You know, but he doesn't have that fierce animalistic, oddly enough, even though he's a wolf man, animalistic feel that Lee's got, but there's something there. And I think a lot of people, yeah, he doesn't have the accent, but Carradine's got that faux British accent he's got, but he doesn't have the, you know, the Hungarian, Transylvanian accent that Lugosi's got, but then Lee doesn't have it later either. Lee just speaks with his normal speaking voice and nobody gives him crap about it. So I think people have kind of started to come around about.
Again, Danny. Though, I mean, I will say this. Yes, he seems like, to me, I would agree that he is more on Bram Stoker's Dracula because he wants to be announced. He wants to be recognized for what he is. But at the same time, like I said, this might be one of the first times that you see Dracula as possibly a sympathetic character because he is duped. He does want a new start. Yes, it is to cause mayhem, but I think there's genuinely something there that he feels for Catherine. He doesn't realize he's being used.
Well, and some of that sympathy, you know, Dracula's daughter, she's very sympathetic. You know, she doesn't want to be a vampire.
Right.
That's probably the first sympathetic vampire on film. And that's the Dracula film that was before, immediately, well, it wasn't immediately because it was several years, but it was the previous Dracula film that Universal did. Because Universal had a weird relationship with Dracula. I mean, they wouldn't make another film with Lugosi. And, you know, and this was, you know, they did Dracula's Daughter, and then they quit doing horror movies for a few years. And it took them a while into the second Universal monster cycle to get to Dracula here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of weird in that way. But, you know, I think you're right. There is some sympathy to be had for Dracula here. But I think a lot of the sympathy for Dracula comes from the character of Barnabas Collins.
Mm.
Because I think, you know, Dan Curtis used Barnabas, you know, helped create, he created Dark Shadows, allowed them to introduce the character of Barnabas Collins as a sympathetic vampire searching for his reincarnated love.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dan Curtis turned around and did his version of Dracula with Jack Palance.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought that over, and that's where you first get the reincarnated love angle that Francis Ford Coppola went to town with in his Dracula. And that's definitely the most sympathetic Dracula,
true.
Although we do have, you know, Frank Langella's Dracula's fairly sympathetic as well, too. But I actually think Frank Langella's a really good blend of the two the two looks at Dracula.
The dichotomies. You know,
the dichotomy. And he's charming as hell, obviously, and very handsome. Uh-huh. So I've really come to like this movie. I like the unusual vampire hunter of the kindly southern doctor as well. I prefer this over any of Universal's other Dracula sequels, including Dracula's Daughter, which I mentioned. I mean, that's a good movie, but I like the story. I like the setting in this one. House of Dracula, it's got Chaney as the Wolfman and Glenn Strange as the Frankenstein monster. It's a lot of fun. It's great. It's got that whole weird thing where they try to say that, you know, Chaney's
swapping
the brain. It's got the pressure on the brain thing.
Oh,
and
all that,
you know, and it's got the weird vampire slash Dr. Mr. Hyde thing going on with the Onslow Stevens character. And I just, you know, this film, I don't know, to me, this is going to be blasphemous to some people. I love Bela Lugosi as Dracula, but the way that film was directed for the most part is so, and I know everybody says this, but it really is. It's so very stagey.
Mm-hmm.
It's so very, you know, shot with a still camera. It just doesn't hold up as a piece of cinema as well as Frankenstein that came out the same year. So I actually like watching this movie better, even though Lugosi's obviously a better Dracula. You know what I'm saying? Even though Chaney's good, Lugosi's the better. But this is a better movie to watch overall. So I really like it. If you guys haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. I don't know exactly. I'm sure it's available. I think it's still available in the Dracula Blu-ray and DVD sets that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's on there. It's on the DVD set I got. And if you haven't seen it in a while or never seen it, give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had seen it before.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, I knew you did. I'm not going to pull a Dr. Fibes on you. We'll take a quick break and then come back with some amazing friends. Don't worry. We'll social distance. Don't go away.
Prepare for a spine-tingling, nerve-shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Here are your hosts, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classic and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit monsterkidradio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodgson. Listen to discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the head of Rondo Hatton, only on Monster Kid Radio.
It's midnight, the podcasting hour. From fetid swamps to creepy castles, the podcasting hour is your home for horror on the Fire and Water Network. Join me, PJ Frightful, on this quarterly anthology podcast that gazes into the mysterious and terrifying shadows of DC Comics. The moon is full and the bell tolls for midnight, the podcasting hour.
No, I can't forget tomorrow when I think of all my sorrow. Well, I had you there, but then I let you go. And now it's only fair that I should let you know what you should know. I can't give
Okay, we're back, and rather than grab a comic from the crypt, this time we're once more hacking into the House of Frankenstein's Disney Plus account and checking out an episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Bride of Dracula premiered on September 24th, 1983.
Hey, before Halloween.
Well, before Christmas too, but technically, yeah. But before Halloween, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, close enough, right, to Halloween, yeah. Written by Jack Mendelsohn and directed by Don Jerwick. In the cast, we had Dan Gilvezan as Spider-Man Peter Parker, Frank Welker as Iceman Bobby Drake and the Wolf Thing, Kathy Garver as Firestar and Angelica Jones, Stan Jones as Dracula, and Walker Edmonston as Frankenstein's monster.
Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. Iceman and Firestar. His Amazing Friends.
At the Eastern State University spring dance, Peter Parker and Bobby Drake argue over which one of them will get to have the first dance with their roommate, Angelica Jones. While they are squabbling, Angelica dances off with a mysterious, handsome stranger with a vague European accent. Peter's spider sense is set off, and he and Bobby follow the dancing couple outside. There, tall, dark, and pervy tells Angelica he has waited for her for centuries. Then he stares at her and hypnotizes her, controlling her will. Just in case you weren't sure he wasn't the Dracula you saw on the title card, he shows off his fangs and laughs maniacally.
Peter and Bobby miss this, but when they ask Angelica about their dances, she totally ignores them and walks off with her new beau, entering his chauffeured limousine. They overhear Mr. Smooth telling his rather furry and growling driver, Bruno, to take them to the airport. Peter and Bobby... Hey, is this the Brady Bunch? Quickly surmise that something is indeed wrong and change into their superhero identities to chase the car to the airport. There, Angelica and her two kidnappers transfer to a black private jet and take off.
Spidey and Iceman are too late to stop them and have no idea where they are headed, so Spidey crawls up to the control tower and takes a peek at their logs. The jet's destination? Transylvania. Whereas Iceman puts it,
where all the vampires come from?
That's some stereotyping there, kids. Angelica and her abductors fly the unfriendly skies, and Count Charming is happy for the storms and turbulence blocking anyone who may be trying to follow him. He takes this opportunity to assume his true form, that of Count Dracula.
Now I can safely assume my true identity.
Count Dracula!
I know, you're shocked.
Spider-Man and Iceman hitch a ride on the outside of a passenger plane that eventually catches up to the Drac jet. Spidey leaps from one plane to the other to check on Angelica. Like a gremlin in William Shatner, Angelica notices Spider-Man looking through her window and briefly snaps out of her trance. Dracula isn't having any of that, so he puts the psychic whammy on Spidey, forcing him to let go of the plane and plummet to the earth below. Thankfully, Iceman is paying attention and makes some ice slides so he can reach Spidey in time and somehow get back up to their own plane.
Dracula wonders why Angelica is getting such super attention, so he decides to eliminate the competition by using his apparently long-range hypnosis to force the pilot of their plane to attempt an emergency landing. Spidey and Iceman are now grounded, and the black jet is soon approaching Castle Dracula. But they are coming in hot, according to the rather worried werewolf, so Dracula casts a spell that turns the jet into some strange bat-like plane that probably had DC's lawyers reaching for their phones.
Dracula shows Angelica the outside of their new home, and they are greeted by the help, namely Frankenstein's monster. Frankie isn't big on guests, saying,
"Strangers mean trouble."
Drac has Frank prepped for the vampire lifestyle by placing her in a coffin on a bed of cold earth. Sounds familiar. That's just enough to snap her out of her trance, and Angelica throws her secret identity out the window by instantly changing into Firestar.
Who are you? How did I get here?
I am Count Dracula, and you, my adored one,
are soon to be my bride.
Me? Marry you? Forget it. You wouldn't want me for a wife. I'm too hot to handle. Firestar!
You are Firestar.
And you are staying single. He really is Dracula.
She blasts some fireballs at him in bat form, but Drac quickly puts her back under his spell. He's now even more excited to find he's engaged to a superhero.
Spidey and Iceman are back on their plane, the captain having snapped out of his trance. But the wall crawler peeks into the cabin and discovers they aren't headed for Transylvania and orders Iceman to turn and freeze the tail rudder to steer them onto their course of choice.
The two jump off the plane and conveniently land, each in their own style, at Castle Dracula, where Spider-Sense does the rest. They storm the castle and find an amnesiac Firestar sitting on a throne, soon joined by Dracula, who properly introduces himself.
Firestar? Who is Firestar?
Hey, come on! Snap out of it! The joke's over!
I assure you, it is not a joke. Her mind is completely under my control.
You don't say. And just who are you?
I am Count Dracula. And now, if you will be good enough to leave, we have a wedding to arrange.
Yes, a wedding.
Forget it, friend. We're taking her back where she belongs.
Show him he's wrong, my angel.
Yo! Hey, we're friends, remember?
Destroy them both, starting with Spider-Man.
As you command.
He then orders his bride to destroy her former friends. When that doesn't work, he orders Bruno the Wolf Thing and Frankie to join in. The heroes try to retreat, but Drac and Firestar follow. Once again, she attacks her roommates, but Spider-Man is able to confuse her by reminding her of her life at ESU with Aunt May and fan favorite Miss Lion. Firestar passes out from the middle tug of war and reverts to Angelica. Spidey scoops her up and the heroes retreat once more. They find themselves in a laboratory with Frankie and Bruno in pursuit.
Spidey tries out better living through chemistry, but all the banging about breaks his test tube. Dracula opens a trap door beneath the heroes, but they manage to leap away before falling into the crocodiles below. Frank takes this opportunity to pick Angelica up and then proceeds to the croc pit where he intends to throw her. He really doesn't like strangers.
Dracula isn't too happy to find his servant doesn't approve of his new bride-to-be, but luckily Spidey finds a bottle of ammonia and throws it at the monster's feet. The fumes revive Angelica, who resumes her Firestar form. She's still not sure who Drac is, but Spidey tells her he doesn't care for sunlight, so she pours it on, and Dracula falls.
Who is this hokey Halloween character?
Someone who can't stand sunlight.
Oh, well, in that case, try this on for size.
Stop! No! You are my slave!
Atta girl, Firestar! Spread a little sunshine!
Now look what you've done! I'm changing!
Look what's happening to the robot!
His control of Frankie is disrupted, causing the robot to fall to pieces, and Wolf Thing changes back to Bruno the butler.
But he isn't the only one changed. Dracula reverts to Angelica's dance partner with no memory of who he is. Convenient, but upsetting for the apparently very vain Firestar who imagines herself unforgettable.
Later, back at ESU and apparently the world's longest dance, Bobby and Peter spy Angelica dancing with another stranger and rudely overstep their boundaries and literally carry her off, not allowing her to live her own life.
Man, it sure feels good to be back in the good old U.S. of A.
Right. I had enough adventure to last me for a long time.
Really? Then we'd better put a stop to that.
Pardon me, fella. Mind if we cut in?
Hey, cut it out! What are you guys doing? Oh, you put me down! Come on,
No.
I know you're going to have some thoughts on this one.
Oh, Lord.
But before, we've never covered Spider-Man's Amazing Friends, I don't think, in all the years we've been podcasting. So did you watch this show as a kid?
No.
You really didn't?
No.
Wow. I'm surprised by that.
No, you introduced me to this.
Wow.
I don't ever remember watching this when I was a kid.
That's interesting.
Again, I had five channels.
But one of them was NBC, which it was on.
No.
Okay.
I watched the Super Friends, the end.
Well, I will say, I was really into this the first season or so, because in season two, they shared an hour with the Hulk, which I also really liked. So I know I watched the first two seasons, but then both our NBC stations out of Lexington and Cincinnati seemed to constantly preempt it for local sports. And I think WWF Wrestling took its spot at some point, too. So that might be why you didn't see it, because it might not have been on, you know, late in later years.
I mean, I just don't. I might have and just not forgot it, but I don't remember it from childhood.
Okay. It aired for several years with no new episodes, and this one was part of what is considered season three by IMDb, and there are only like eight or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, now I still have a soft spot for this show. Don't misunderstand me, but right from the first scene, we get one of my number one gripes with this series, the overpowering and repetitive music.
Yes.
Marvel Productions had a very limited music catalog, unlike Universal, at this point. And if there was a dance or a party on this, G.I. Joe, Transformers, maybe Jim, I don't know, you name it, this music here played and played and played. I mean, it's still playing in my head. You know, I mean, as soon as it just comes back, so... Our pal Brian Hyler of Pod Stallions and Plaid Stallions fame says he can't watch these shows due to the music being so loud either, on top of being repetitive.
Right.
It's really loud.
Yeah.
It's overpowering, so I get that, yeah. The title of this episode, Bride of Dracula, actually would have been better than Son of Dracula was for the movie.
Right.
But then they called the Hammer movie, although Dracula's not in that, so they could have called it Rides of the Vampire, which would have made more sense.
Oh, yeah, true.
Count Meinster. Barry Meinster, sorry. So how annoying would it be to be Angelica and have these two constantly fighting for your affections and then be your roommates?
I know.
Imagine if Three's Company, if Chrissy and Janet were like that into Jack all the time and just bugging the crap out of him. And there you have it, just reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So our main cast is headlined by Dan Gilvezan, who has a ton of on-screen and voice cred, but is probably best known as the voice of Bumblebee on the original Transformers series and the animated movie. He was also the voice of Beachhead on G.I. Joe. Now, there was a solo Spider-Man cartoon produced by the same creators with the same model sheets, some of the same scripts, etc. at the same time. Spidey was voiced there by Ted Schwartz, and I have to say, I've always preferred Ted Schwartz's deeper, less, hey, you know, kind of characterization of Spider-Man. It just, to me, it seemed more Spider-Man-like, and it was a little bit closer to the classic 60s cartoon, the Paul Soles Spider-Man, which is what I still think Spider-Man sounds like, so, but that's just me. Iceman is voiced by the reigning king of voiceover actors, Frank Welker. From Fred on Scooby-Doo to Megatron on Transformers, even in the later Michael Bay films,
mm-hmm.
he is the most ubiquitous voice in animation since Mel Blanc, and probably he surpassed him at some point in number
of
roles.
I really would like to, at one point, do an actual comparison, because I bet you it's,
I'd see he's probably been involved in more different productions.
Well, true.
I mean, if you don't count all the Looney Tunes shorts as separate productions, but I guess they kind of are, but...
Because they were
film shorts, but yeah. Danny came in and said, "Is that Fred?" when she heard his voice Iceman. And then when she saw him as Bobby, she's like, "He even looks like Fred."
Yeah.
Kathy Garver is best known for her role of Sissy on Family Affair, but has been busy in voice work for decades since. She was also uncredited in The Ten Commandments when she was very young.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so many people say, "I was in The Ten Commandments." You know,
yeah.
Our mysterious European type, who is very clearly Dracula, is voiced by Stan Jones, who also has tons of voiceover cred, but is probably best known to geeks like us as Lex Luthor on The Super Friends, and he even narrated the opening of the Challenge of the Super Friends.
Mm-hmm.
Gathered together from remote galaxies, you know, that, yeah. 13 of the most dangerous villains of all time, yeah. Man, they waste no time in showing us this guy is bad news. There's no actual romance. other than Angelica being really easily won over with some pickup lines. You know, it's just bam, he hypnotizes her and shows her his fangs.
I'm sorry, but what girl that has any sense goes outside, you know, with somebody she has just met? Duh.
Yeah, he hadn't hypnotized her yet then.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, no.
But she is a superhero that can burst into flames when she needs to. It's kind of like having, like nuclear pepper spray. You know? Just saying. But Dracula, subtle. So.
Yeah.
Drac and Angelica pass a car with a license plate that clearly says Graham. It's so obvious, it's not really even a hidden Easter egg. I don't know who Graham is. Obviously, it's either somebody that works on the show or somebody that somebody works on the show knows. But again, subtle. So, music, not subtle. Dracula, not subtle. Animators, not subtle. So I'm just So they really don't try to hide that the driver is a werewolf.
No.
Yet we don't see him from a front shot for some time. So I wonder, was he supposed to be more heavily shadowed? Was there... were they going to do extra lighting effects to put him in shadow? And they're like, we ran out of the money. We can't do that. You know, or
something.
We're going to blow it later when we have to use the sun effects that Firestar comes up with. So, yeah. Because it's so weird. They, you know, you hear him growl. He's got furry hands with claws. And you can see the back of his head. He's clearly not human.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't show him. When they show his face later, it's supposed to be like, oh, it's a werewolf. It's like...
And yes. The sky's blue.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, yelling Iceman as you build a wall of ice around yourself and smash it doesn't really work like flame on. But ice on sounds too derivative. Maybe go for the cold. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, Firestar.
Yeah, she does the same thing. Spider-Man needs to go Spider-Man as he's taking his clothes off.
Yeah.
Actually, the solo Spider-Man cartoon always did this really cool. They played the same music that dun 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 dun. And when he changed, but they do this thing where it showed like Peter Parker take his jacket off and he like check his web shooters, pull his gloves like he had them flipped down like over and he pull his mask over. And
yeah.
They reused the same animation over and over, but it was kind of a cool
effect.
So it was better than yelling Iceman, Firestar, you know. But Wonder Twin powers activate, at least that's something, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Dracula has a dedicated manservant and a black private jet. Is this guy Dracula or Bruce Wayne?
He kind of looks like Bruce
he
Wayne.
He looks like Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. The bit where Spidey spooks the guy on the control tower is kind of cute. I guess the pressure is finally getting to me.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, if you saw Spider-Man, what?
But you are in New York, so, you know. J. Jonah Jameson's constantly griping about Spider-Man, so. But as we joked in the synopsis, Transylvania isn't just a country in Europe. It's literally home to monsters. It's kind of like saying, they're taking her to Egypt. Oh, no, mummies.
Yeah.
Bruno finally turns around and we see he is indeed a werewolf, to no one's surprise, as we said. But now, I do have to question, why does Dracula think anyone would follow them? At this point, he doesn't know he kidnapped a superhero.
Right.
And he's very surprised when he finds out he has kidnapped a superhero.
Yeah.
So why would anybody, you know, be able to follow him in a private jet looking for Angelica Jones? But, okay, whatever. I'm disappointed that Marvel Productions didn't take this opportunity to give us their versions of the classic monsters from the comics. Dracula has light gray skin, white temples, and a goatee. He doesn't look like Gene Colan's Dracula from Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah.
And Bruno is no Jack Russell Werewolf by Night either. So
I'm still that the name.
I know you still love that Jack Russell. That's as bad as Al Ucard, honestly. So I guess we should be glad Spidey just didn't try to enter the plane and depressurize the cabin. But couldn't he have been a bit stealthier about things, you know, like kind of hanging back and like looking into the... But he like straight on just like looks in the window with his whole head in the window.
I know! Like, I'm like, dude!
Just alerted the dude that kidnapped her that you're there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like... Yeah. And then, you know, Dracula puts the psychic whammy on him, as we said. Spider-Man falls. But Where are Iceman's ice slides connecting to?
That's what I was wondering too, but I was just, I thought that when we were watching, I'm like,
there's no, like, there's no,
they're in the air.
There's no support beam showing it. And then how to get back up to their plane? Because it shows Dracula's plane below them, and Spidey jumps down. How's he get back up?
Yeah. I just went with it's in the script.
Right. Yeah.
It, you know, I was like, yeah.
You know, Dracula hypnotizes the captain of the Spidey and Iceman's plane, and the co-pilot just goes along with the captain's totally unnecessary emergency landing. I guess he figures he gets paid either way.
It's like, what? I mean, he does say what?
He does question it, but he's like, well, you're the captain. It's like, we're going down in flames, Johnny. It's been good to know you. Oh, you're the captain. Yes. Oh, so Dracula, like, has this weird spell thing. He does like a Doctor Strange thing. He does a Benedict Cumberbatch and does
the swirly. You know, Doctor Strange was doing the round Goldie thing.
Right, exactly. He does that, and the plane changes into a really weird looking bat plane. So this guy is Bruce Wayne. What do you think about that?
I was just like, what?
That was just a total weird thing for no real reason.
And who knew? I mean, I didn't know that any Dracula ever had that power.
They can change metal.
To transfigure things.
Transfigure metal and
transfiguration.
Things. Yeah. I love Kathy Garver's delivery of Hypnotize Angelica's lines. I am so happy. That's like, she went to the Robin Curtis School of Delivery. David is dead. Waiting for the comments on that one, guys. I'm just Rob will be like, oh, Chris, no. And poor Robin Curtis. She's fine otherwise, but that line still gets me. So the creators get around the idea of a guy made of corpses by having Frankie look like a straight-up robot. I mean, you can see, like, the joints and the bolts in him and his arms. He still has a flat-top head and neck bolts, though.
Yeah.
But, and his head kind of still looks undead, but the rest of him looks like he's a robot. So, yeah. We get the cold earth bit again, but it's important to the story, too, because it wakes her up enough to become Firestar.
I know. I liked that, you know, because that shock to her system, you know?
Yeah. I will admit, like every straight boy my age, I, of course, had a crush on Firestar.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't hurt. She kind of looked naked in that blank body suit. Although, by this point, they had kind of toned down some of her curves. Apparently, the network censors were like, dudes, enough with the butt shots, you know, so basically, you know, I think so, you know. And I always wondered why Angelica looks so much like Mary Jane Watson.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because John Romita Sr. designed both characters.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, he's like, hey, this is a good design. But when the first time it ever came on, you know, it just said Iceman and Firestar, and it showed her in her civilian guise. I'm like, oh man, they made Mary Jane a superhero.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then they said her name was Angelica Jones. I'm like, what?
What? That was funny.
Now, where did Stan Lee come from in this episode?
Speaking of trouble, he never expected the cold, cold earth to snap Angelica right out of her trance.
He didn't, he provides narration in, like, I think second season onward, and I think he may have went back and recorded some narration for the first season when they began airing it in syndication. They had a thing called the Marvel Action Universe for a while, and they'd show the two Spider-Man cartoons from this time, RoboCop animated series, and I think, like, Dino Riders or something. I never could, it was always airing, like, at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. I'm like, I'm not getting up for that. But, you know, Stan doesn't narrate the beginning. He does like, hey, true believers, we're at Eastern State University where our heroes are at a dance. You know, and like, I mean, it's just, he comes in the middle and just starts talking. And it's like, that's weird. So it makes me wonder, was there opening narration that's cut in this version that's on Disney Plus? Or if you guys know and know of another version of this one, let us know. Because I'm just kind of curious about that.
Right.
Yeah. I do like Angelica or Firestar's line of, you are staying single. but were you annoyed that he put her back under his spell after that triumphant transformation?
Yes.
It was pretty annoying, yeah.
Mm.
Stan refers to Iceman as Spidey's frisky little frozen friend. Okay. So Spidey and Iceman just change the course of the plane, never minding the fact that they may be stopping the passengers from reaching some important destination.
I know. I mean, what about, you know, other people's lives matter too, their boys.
Yeah, exactly. They don't care. They just don't care. The captain says the whole flight is jinxed, and the co-pilot points out they are over Transylvania. Again, these people are not very enlightened.
And the thing is, a lot of times planes only have so much fuel on them.
Right.
So what if they went, you know... They might really have to do an emergency landing.
They might, yeah, because they are emergency landed once. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course, either Transylvania is very small or that castle is very big because they go straight to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, yeah. I mean, it might have been fun if they were like, it's like, hey, because they could probably see the castle as big as it was. You know, mm-hmm. if Spider-Man was like, I bet you I know where they're at. Well, how do you know? Look. You know, it's like, or his spider sense went off above it, you know. Which it doesn't. So they meet, you know, Firestar and Dracula, and she's in a trance, and she starts firing her, you know, fire bolts at Spidey, and he says, being in a trance has improved her aim. That's pretty insulting, actually.
I'm sorry, but I would toast his ass.
I'd like, you know, next time he's swinging, just kind of zap one of his, send him falling a little bit, yeah. Drac calls Bruno Wolf Thing, and I now want a comic called Giant Size Wolf Thing. Mm. We can have Giant Size Man Thing. We can have Giant Size Wolf Thing. Spidey tells her to think of ESU, Aunt May, and Miss Lyon, the latter of which aren't in this episode. Miss Lyon was the show's concession to the cute animal sidekick rule of the 70s and 80s that plagued all children of the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
Thank you, Hanna-Barbera. Thank you, Marvel Productions. Thank you, Filmation. We didn't want those characters, and we never did. And
The only cute animal sidekick is Scooby-Doo.
Well, I mean, and that was the whole premise of the show.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, don't add on cute sidekicks that don't belong in a property. But
maybe Gleek.
Maybe Glee. Okay, maybe Glee.
Sorry.
Aunt May on Spider-Man's Amazing Friends, who again is not in this episode other than the image we see of her, was mm-hmm. voiced by June Foray, who was, of course, the voice of Granny on Looney Tunes and Rocky the Squirrel and mm-hmm. the voice of everything. So, I always assumed ESU meant Empire State University, like the comics, not Eastern State University, which is kind of weird, but... Maybe they didn't want it to be quite so New York-y. I don't know.
Right.
But it's Marvel. Everybody lives in New York. So the visual of when Spidey's telling her, think of Aunt May, think of Miss Lyon, is pretty weird. It shows images of the college and the characters, like, on her forehead.
Well, you know, she had that part going on, so, you know, it's big, you know, yeah. billboard space.
So, I always thought her hair was cool, how it was, like, different shades of red.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a cool look. It's like, how does that work? Like, is her hair like fire, like Firestorm, or it doesn't look like it. It's just like, I don't know, I'm thinking too much about it.
Yeah.
So.
She had highlights put in. She had one of those caps where you pull it out, you know.
Yeah, but how did she go from Angelica to that? I mean, she burned her hair wig off or something?
It's in the script.
It's in the script. I know. I'm glad to see Spidey try and do something with chemicals, but why is Drac keeping a trap door full of crocodiles in his lab? I know later we learned they're not crocodiles, but
right,
a lab's a weird place to have that. But
yeah,
it's Castle Dracula, I guess. Frankenstein holds her in the air for like 5 minutes. I mean, her and Spidey have a full conversation while he and Drac are just standing there. I mean, mm-hmm. pacing people. You know, he's like, you know, Stranger's bad. He's like, he's got her over his head, and he's just like, but he's like, okay, are you going to do it or not? You know, it's like, he's not really committed to it, maybe. I don't know.
Or maybe, you know, he's that problem with the joint. It's not wanting to do that maybe swing down.
He's
you know?
Rusted. Oral can, you know, or something. I like the fact that Firestar gets to defeat these guys after being a victim for this whole episode. That's nice. I don't even mind Frankie conveniently exploding or Bruno reverting to the butler, who's in different clothes, by the way, which is weird.
Uh-huh.
We've seen Drac have powers like this before, but him changing back to his human form and being amnesiac is a bit too convenient. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, why does he turn back to that guy?
Uh-huh.
You know? I don't know. Even the crocodiles were salamanders, which is kind of weird. Why even put them in that? They must have been running out of time.
Yeah. Or something. So there must be.
But they got to have something for Frankenstein to try to throw her into, mm-hmm. even though he, again, wasn't into it. So how about that ending? You were a victim before, but now we won't let you have any agency of your own. You're not allowed to dance with anybody but us. You know?
I got up and left.
You did? When
I was like, oh, that's bullshit. Got up and left.
And also when she said, a woman likes to think she's unforgettable. And you're like, oh. When I was a kid, I felt this series was more sophisticated than the Super Friends. That it skewed just a bit older. Now, I really can't see it watching it now. Beyond the heroes being more quippy, it's just as illogical and silly as Super Friends often was and can be. It's clearly aimed at a young crowd, and that's fine. It's fine that it's aimed at a young crowd. Again, like we said last year, it was never intended to be scrutinized by two 40-year-olds, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. We're just having fun. But I think the quippiness actually undermines any tension the stories may have, because when Dracula showed up on Super Friends, it was actually kind of scary.
Right.
I mean, that episode is kind of scary. I mean, it's not like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight, but it's spooky for the Super Friends. He seemed evil and threatening, and Firestar here is like, he really is Dracula. And that's the way she says it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she's just like, they're never really afraid of what they're seeing facing or anything. She's just, you know, just as if she said, he really is a mime or something like that. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just, there's no weight to it because it's all hippie tongue in cheek, you know, it's very hip. So, but you know, again, not trying to beat up on it. It's fun and I have a fond spot for it, even though, you know, it was a fun Halloween episode of the show. And there's certainly other episodes that are a little less silly than this one. But, well, that'll do it for our first trip this year to the House of Frankenstein, or House of Frankenstein. Thanks to everyone for listening and sharing, liking the social media posts we make on it. Thanks to everyone who has been running our new trailer, like Derek M. Cook over at the wonderful Monster Kid Radio you heard of earlier in the promo segment. Of course, if you're listening to this show, you should definitely check out Monster Kid Radio. We'll have some other shows that we'll run trailers for that cover horror movies all year long, not just, you know, 2 months a year like we do. But so there's plenty of places to go when the House of Frankenstein is closed for the seasons. If you are interested, we've got some new House of Frankenstein merch available in our TeePublic store featuring this year's artwork designed by yours truly.
It's very cool. Oh my gosh, I can't wait till our order comes in.
Well, it was inspired by an old Halloween treat bag that my dad found in among school papers that my mom had kept. And I just thought that was a really cool bag. I put it in with my monster display. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's kind of the look I'm going for.
Right.
And I mean, I didn't like totally rip it off, but it's got the feel of that.
Right.
So go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and click on the merch button to see all our FW designs there. Not just our shows, but the other guys' shows. Thanks to the patrons who support us and help keep our lights on. This time of year, in this house, we really need them.
Extra special thanks to Jorge Luis Castillo and Matt Ryan for specifically supporting our JLU cast. We go on hiatus for a bit and get two patrons asking to be mentioned on JLU cast. Maybe they want us to stay away.
Since we can't thank you over there for a few months, we'll thank you here. Much appreciated, Jorge and Matt.
Go to patreon.com/FWPodcast to see the many ways you can help support the network and all the shows here.
Special thanks to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry, for the House of Frankenstein theme. He even provided us with an instrumental version for use in our trailer this year. So thanks as always, Terry. We love it.
Come back in 2 weeks for another trip to the House of Frankenstein. One hint, it's hammer time. See you then.
Bye.
Super Mates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. It is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
And the smell of black coal with 100 miles of track and the wind at your back with a sleeper car full of dead souls. Fly, death angels, fly from the dining car to the bar. Well, every neck gets slip where the blood runs and drips from travelers both near and far. On this terror train, this terror train, this Transylvania terror train. Scream, lonely screams, as the train screeches to a halt. So that old whistle blows into that haunted depot. Getting on that train was all your fault. On this terror train, this terror train, this Transylvania terror train.
I command you to release her. I am your master.
Destroyed must be destroyed.